The attacks had occurred only a year earlier, during my junior year of high school. Like any self-respecting hillbilly, I considered heading to the Middle East to kill terrorists. But the prospect of military service, the screaming drill instructors, the constant exercise, the separation from my family, frightened me. Until Rachel told me to talk to a recruiter, implicitly arguing that she thought I could handle it, joining the Marines seemed as plausible as flying to Mars. Now, just weeks before I owed a tuition deposit to Ohio State, I could think of nothing but the Marine Corps. So one Saturday in late March, I walked into a military recruiter's office and asked him about the Marine Corps. He didn't try to sell me on anything. He told me I'd make very little money and I might even go to war. But they'll teach you about leadership, and they'll turn you into a disciplined young man. This piqued my interest, but the notion of JD the U.S. Marine still inspired disbelief. I was a pudgy, long-haired kid. When our gym teacher told us to run a mile, I'd walk at least half. I'd never woken up before 6 a.m., and here was this organization promising that I'd rise regularly at 5 a.m. and run multiple miles per day. I went home and considered my options. I reminded myself that my country needed me, and that I'd always regret not participating in America's newest war. I thought about the GI Bill and how it could help me trade indebtedness for financial freedom. I knew that, most of all, I had no other choice. There was college, or nothing, or the Marines, and I didn't like either of the first two options. 4 years in the Marines, I told myself, would help me become the person I wanted to be. But I didn't want to leave home. Lindsay had just had her second kid, an adorable little girl, and was expecting a third, and my nephew was still a toddler. Lori's kids were still babies, too. The more I thought about it, the less I wanted to do it. And I knew that if I waited too long, I'd talk myself out of enlisting. So 2 weeks later, as the Iraq crisis turned into the Iraq War, I signed my name on a dotted line and promised the Marine Corps the first 4 years of my adult life. At first, my family scoffed. The Marines weren't for me, and people let me know it. Eventually, knowing I wouldn't change my mind, everyone came around, and a few even seemed excited. Everyone, that is, save Mamaw. She tried every manner of persuasion. You're a fucking idiot. They'll chew you up and spit you out. Who's going to take care of me? You're too stupid for the Marines. You're too smart for the Marines. With everything that's going on in the world, you'll get your head blown off. Do you want to be around for Lindsay's kids? I'm worried, and I don't want you to go. Though she came to accept the decision, she never liked it. Shortly before I left for boot camp, the recruiter visited to speak with my fragile grandmother. She met him outside, stood up as straight as she could, and glowered at him. Set one foot on my fucking porch and I'll blow it off, she advised. I thought she might be serious, he later told me. So they had their talk while he stood in the front yard. My greatest fear when I left for boot camp wasn't that I'd be killed in Iraq or that I'd fail to make the cut. I hardly worried about those things. But when Mom, Lindsay, and Aunt Wee drove me to the bus that would take me to the airport and on to boot camp from there, I imagined my life 4 years later, and I saw a world without my grandmother in it. Something inside me knew that she wouldn't survive my time in the Marines. I'd never come home again, at least not permanently. Home was Middletown with Mamaw in it, and by the time I finished with the Marines, Mamaw would be gone. Marine Corps boot camp lasts 13 weeks, each with a new training focus. The night I arrived in Parris Island, South Carolina, an angry drill instructor greeted my group as we disembarked from the plane. He ordered us onto a bus. After a short trip, another drill instructor ordered us off the bus and onto the famed Yellow Footprints. Over the next 6 hours, I was poked and prodded by medical personnel, assigned equipment and uniforms, and lost all of my hair. We were allowed one phone call, so I naturally called Mamaw and read off the card they gave me. I have arrived safely at Parris Island. I will send my address soon. Goodbye. Wait, you little shithead. Are you okay? Sorry, Mamaw. Can't talk, but yes, I'm okay. I'll ride as soon as I can. The drill instructor, overhearing my two extra lines of conversation, asked sarcastically whether I'd made enough time for her to tell you a fucking story. That was the first day. There are no phone calls in boot camp. I was allowed only one, to call Lindsay when her half-brother died. I realized, through letters, how much my family loved me. While most other recruits, that's what they called us, we had to earn the title Marine by completing the rigors of boot camp, received a letter every day or two, I sometimes received a half dozen each night. Mamaw wrote every day, sometimes several times, offering extended thoughts on what was wrong with the world in some and few-sentence streams of consciousness in others. Most of all, Mama wanted to know how my days were going and reassure me. Recruiters told families that what most of us needed were words of encouragement, and Mama delivered that in spades. As I struggled with screaming drill instructors and physical fitness routines that pushed my out-of-shape body to its limits, I read every day that Mama was proud of me, that she loved me, and that she knew I wouldn't give up. Thanks to either my wisdom or inherited hoarder tendencies, I managed to keep nearly every one of the letters I received from my family. Many of them shed an interesting light on the home I left behind. A letter from Mom asking me what I might need and telling me how proud she is of me. I was babysitting Lindsay's kids, she reports. They played with slugs outside. They squeezed one and killed it, but I threw it away and told them they didn't because Cam got a little upset, thinking he killed it. This is Mom at her best, loving and funny, a woman who delighted in her grandchildren. In the same letter, a reference to Greg, likely a boyfriend who has since disappeared from my memory, and an insight into our sense of normalcy. Mandy's husband Terry, she starts, referencing a friend of hers, was arrested on a probation violation and sent to prison, so they are all doing okay. Lindsay wrote often, sending multiple letters in the same envelope, each on a different colored piece of paper, with instructions on the back. Read this one second. This is the last one. Every single letter contains some reference to her kids. I learned of my oldest niece's successful potty training, my nephew's soccer matches, my younger niece's early smiles and first efforts to reach for things. After a lifetime of shared triumphs and tragedies, we both adored her kids more than anything else. Almost all of the letters I sent home asked her to kiss the babies and tell them that I love them. Cut off, for the first time, from home and family, I learned a lot about myself and my culture. Contrary to conventional wisdom, the military is not a landing spot for low-income kids with no other options. The 69 members of my boot camp platoon included black, white, and Hispanic kids, rich kids from upstate New York and poor kids from West Virginia, Catholics, Jews, Protestants, and even a few atheists. I was naturally drawn to those like me. The person I talked to most, I wrote to my family in my first letter home, is from Leslie County, Kentucky. He talks like he's from Jackson. I was telling him how much bullshit it was that Catholics got all the free time they did. They get it because of the way the church schedule works. He is definitely a country kid, because he said, "What's a Catholic?" And I told him that it was just another form of Christianity, and he said, "I might have to try that out." Mama understood precisely where he came from. "Down in that part of Kentucky, everybody's a snake handler," she wrote back, only partially joking. During my time away, Mama showed vulnerability that I'd never seen before. Whenever she received a letter from me, she would call my aunt or sister, demanding that someone come to her house immediately and interpret my chicken scratch. "I love you a big bunch, and I miss you a bunch. I forget you aren't here. I think you will come down the stairs and I can holler at you. It is just a feeling you aren't really gone. My hands hurt today, that arthritis, I guess. I'll go for now, write more later, love you, please take care." Mamaw's letters never contained the necessary punctuation and always included some articles, usually from Reader's Digest, to occupy my time. She could still be classic Mamaw, mean and ferociously loyal. About a month into my training, I had a nasty exchange with a drill instructor who took me aside for a half hour, forcing me to alternate jumping jacks, sit-ups, and short sprints until I was completely exhausted. It was par for the course in boot camp, something nearly everyone faced at one point or another. If anything, I was lucky to have avoided it for so long. "Dearest JD," Mama wrote when she learned of the incident, "I must say, I have been waiting for them dick-faced bastards to start on you, and now they have. Words aren't invented to describe how they piss me off. You just keep on doing the best you can do, and keep thinking about this stupid asshole with an IQ of 2, thinking he is Bobby Badass, but he wears girls' underwear. I hate all of them." When I read that outburst, I figured Mamaw had gotten it all off her chest. But the next day, she had more to say. "Hello, sweetheart. All I can think about is them dicks screaming at you. That is my job, not them fuckers. Just kidding. I know you will be whatever you want to be because you are smart, something they aren't, and they know it. I hate them all. Really hate their guts. Screaming is part of the game they play. You carry on as best you can. You will come out ahead." I had the meanest old hillbilly staunchly in my corner, even if she was hundreds of miles away. In boot camp, mealtime is a marvel of efficiency. You walk through a cafeteria line, holding your tray for the service staff. They drop all of the day's offerings on your plate, both because you're afraid to speak up about your least favorite items, and because you're so hungry that you'd gladly eat a dead horse. You sit down, and without looking at your plate, that would be unprofessional, or moving your head, that would also be unprofessional, you shovel food into your mouth until you're told to stop. The entire process takes no longer than 8 minutes, and if you're not quite full by the end, you certainly suffer from indigestion, which feels about the same. The only discretionary part of the exercise is dessert, set aside on small plates at the end of the assembly line. During the first meal of boot camp, I grabbed the offered piece of cake and marched to my seat. If nothing else tastes good, I thought, this cake shall certainly be the exception. Then my drill instructor, a skinny white man with a Tennessee twang, stepped in front of me. He looked me up and down with his small, intense eyes and offered a query. You really need that cake, don't you, fat ass? I prepared to answer, but the question was apparently rhetorical, as he smacked the cake out of my hands and moved on to his next victim. I never grabbed the cake again. There was an important lesson here, but not one about food or self-control or nutrition. If you told me that I'd react to such an insult by cleaning up the cake and heading back to my seat, I'd never have believed you. The trials of my youth instilled a debilitating self-doubt. Instead of congratulating myself on having overcome some obstacles, I worried that I'd be overcome by the next ones. Marine Corps boot camp, with its barrage of challenges big and small, began to teach me that I had underestimated myself. Marine Corps boot camp is set up as a life-defining challenge. From the day you arrive, no one calls you by your first name. You're not allowed to say I because you're taught to mistrust your own individuality. Every question begins with this recruit. This recruit needs to use the head, the bathroom. This recruit needs to visit the corpsman, the doctor. The few idiots who arrive at boot camp with Marine Corps tattoos are mercilessly berated. At every turn, recruits are reminded that they are worthless until they finish boot camp and earn the title Marine. Our platoon started with 83, and by the time we finished, 69 remained. Those who dropped out, mostly for medical reasons, served to reinforce the worthiness of the challenge. Every time the drill instructor screamed at me and I stood proudly. Every time I thought I'd fall behind during a run and kept up. Every time I learned to do something I thought impossible, like climb the rope, I came a little closer to believing in myself. Psychologists call it learned helplessness when a person believes, as I did during my youth, that the choices I made had no effect on the outcomes in my life. From Middletown's world of small expectations to the constant chaos of our home, life had taught me that I had no control. Mamaw and Papaw had saved me from succumbing entirely to that notion, and the Marine Corps broke new ground. If I had learned helplessness at home, the Marines were teaching learned willfulness. The day I graduated from boot camp was the proudest of my life. An entire crew of hillbillies showed up for my graduation, 18 in total, including Mamaw, sitting in a wheelchair, buried underneath a few blankets, looking frailer than I remembered. I showed everyone around base, feeling like I had just won the lottery, and when I was released for a 10-day leave the next day, we caravanned back to Middletown. On my first day home from boot camp, I walked into the barber shop of my grandfather's old friend. Marines have to keep their hair short, and I didn't want to slack just because no one was watching. For the first time, the corner barber, a dying breed, even though I didn't know it at the time, greeted me as an adult. I sat in his chair, told some dirty jokes, most of which I'd learned only weeks earlier, and shared some boot camp stories. When he was about my age, he was drafted into the Army to fight in Korea, so we traded some barbs about the Army and the Marines. After the haircut, he refused to take my money and told me to stay safe. He'd cut my hair before, and I'd walked by his shop nearly every day for 18 years. Yet it was the first time he'd ever shaken my hand and treated me as an equal. I had a lot of those experiences shortly after boot camp. In those first days as a Marine, all spent in Middletown, every interaction was a revelation. I'd shed 45 pounds, so many of the people I knew barely recognized me. My friend Nate, who would later serve as one of my groomsmen, did a double take when I extended my hand at a local mall. Perhaps I carried myself a little differently, My old hometown seemed to think so. The new perspective went both ways. Many of the foods that I ate once now violated the fitness standards of a Marine. In Mamaw's house, everything was fried. Chicken, pickles, tomatoes. That bologna sandwich on toast with crumbled potato chips as topping no longer appeared healthy. Blackberry cobbler, once considered as healthy as any dish built around fruit, blackberries, and grains, flour, lost its luster. I began asking questions I'd never asked before. Is there added sugar? Does this meat have a lot of saturated fat? How much salt? It was just food, but I was already realizing that I'd never look at Middletown the same way again. In a few short months, the Marine Corps had already changed my perspective. I soon left home for a permanent assignment in the Marine Corps, and life at home continued on apace. I tried to return as often as I could, and with long weekends and generous Marine Corps leave, I usually saw my family every few months. The kids looked a lot bigger every time I saw them, and Mom moved in with Mamaw not long after I left for boot camp, though she didn't plan to stay. Mamaw's health seemed to improve. She was walking better and even putting on a bit of weight. Lindsay and Aunt Wee, as well as their families, were healthy and happy. My greatest fear before I left was that some tragedy would befall my family while I was away, and I'd be unable to help. Luckily, that wasn't happening. In January 2005, I learned that my unit would head to Iraq a few months later. I was both excited and nervous. Mamaw fell silent when I called to tell her. After a few uncomfortable seconds of dead air, she said only that she hoped the war would end before I had to leave. Though we spoke on the phone every few days, we never spoke of Iraq, even as winter turned to spring and everyone knew I'd be leaving for war that summer. I could tell that Mamaw didn't want to talk or think about it, and I obliged. Mamaw was old, frail, and sick. I no longer lived with her, and I was preparing to go fight a war. Though her health had improved somewhat since I'd left the Marines, she still took a dozen medications and made quarterly trips to the hospital for various ailments. When A.K. Steele, which provided health care for Mamaw as Papaw's widow, announced that they were increasing her premiums, Mamaw simply couldn't afford them. She barely survived as it was, and she needed $300 extra per month. She told me as much one day, and I immediately volunteered to cover the costs. She had never accepted anything from me, not money from my paycheck at Dillman's, not a share of my boot camp earnings, but she accepted my $300 a month, and that's how I knew she was desperate. I didn't make a lot of money myself, probably $1,000 a month after taxes, though the Marines gave me a place to stay and food to eat, so that money went far. I also made extra money playing online poker. Poker was in my blood. I'd played with pennies and dimes with Papaw and my great uncles as far back as I could remember, and the online poker craze at the time made it basically free money. I played 10 hours a week on small stakes tables, earning $400 a month. I'd planned to save that money, but instead I gave it to Mamaw for her health insurance. Mamaw naturally worried that I had picked up a gambling habit and was playing cards in some mountain trailer with a bunch of card-sharking hillbillies, but I assured her that it was online and legitimate. Well, you know I don't understand the fucking internet. Just don't turn to booze and women. That's always what happens to dipshits who get caught up in gambling. Mamaw and I both loved the movie Terminator 2. We probably watched it together 5 or 6 times. Mamaw saw Arnold Schwarzenegger as the embodiment of the American dream, a strong, capable immigrant coming out on top. But I saw the movie as a sort of metaphor for my own life. Mamaw was my keeper, my protector, and if need be, my own goddamn Terminator. No matter what life threw at me, I'd be okay because she was there to protect me. Paying for her health insurance made me feel, for the first time in my life, like I was the protector. It gave me a sense of satisfaction that I'd never imagined, and how could I? I'd never had the money to help people before the Marines. When I came home, I was able to take Mom out to lunch, get ice cream for the kids, and buy nice Christmas presents for Lindsay. On one of my trips home, Mamaw and I took Lindsay's 2 oldest kids on a trip to Hocking Hills State Park, a beautiful region of Appalachian, Ohio, to meet up with Aunt Wee and Dan. I drove the whole way, I paid for gas, and I bought everyone dinner, admittedly, at Wendy's. I felt like such a man, a real grown-up. To laugh and joke with the people I loved most, as they scarfed down the meal that I'd provided gave me a feeling of joy and accomplishment that words can't possibly describe. For my entire life, I had oscillated between fear at my worst moments and a sense of safety and stability at my best. I was either being chased by the bad Terminator or protected by the good one. But I had never felt empowered, never believed that I had the ability and the responsibility to care for those I loved. Mamaw could preach about responsibility and hard work, about making something out of myself and not making excuses. No pep talk or speech could show me how it felt to transition from seeking shelter to providing it. I had to learn that for myself, and once I did, there was no going back. Mamaw's 72nd birthday was in April 2005. Just a couple of weeks before then, I stood in the waiting room of a Walmart supercenter as car technicians changed my oil. I called Mamaw on the cell phone that I'd paid for myself, and she told me about babysitting Lindsay's kids that day. "Megan is so damn cute," she told me. I told her to shit in the pot, and for 3 hours she just kept saying, "Shit in the pot, shit in the pot, shit in the pot," over and over again. I told her that she had to stop or I'd get in trouble, but she never did. I laughed, told Mamaw that I loved her, and let her know that her monthly $300 check was on the way. "JD, thank you for helping me. I'm very proud of you, and I love you." 2 days later, I awoke on a Sunday morning to a call from my sister, who said that Mamaw's lung had collapsed, that she was lying in the hospital in a coma, and that I should come home as quickly as possible. 2 hours later, I was on the road. I packed my dress blue uniform just in case I needed it for a funeral. On the way, a West Virginia police officer pulled me over for going 94 on I-77. He asked why I was in such a hurry, and when I explained, he told me that the highway was clear of speed traps for the next 70 miles, after which I'd cross into Ohio, and that I should go as fast as I wanted until then. I took my warning ticket, thanked him profusely, and drove 102 until I crossed the state line. I made the 13-hour trip in just under 11 hours. When I arrived at Middletown Regional Hospital at 11 in the evening, my entire family was gathered around Mamaw's bed. She was unresponsive, and though her lung had been reinflated, the infection that had caused it to collapse showed no signs of responding to treatment. Until that happened, the doctor told us, it would be torture to wake her, if she could be awakened at all. We waited a few days for signs that the infection was surrendering to the medication. But the signs showed the opposite. Her white blood cell count continued to rise, and some of her organs showed evidence of severe stress. Her doctor explained that she had no realistic chance of living without a ventilator and feeding tube. We all conferred and decided that if, after a day, Mamaw's white blood cell count increased further, we would pull the plug. Legally, it was Aunt Wee's sole decision, and I'll never forget when she tearfully asked whether I thought she was making a mistake. To this day, I'm convinced that she, and we, made the right decision. I guess it's impossible to know for sure. I wished at the time that we had a doctor in the family. The doctor told us that without the ventilator, Mamaw would die within 15 minutes, an hour at most. She lasted instead for 3 hours, fighting to the very last minute. Everyone was present. Uncle Jimmy, Mom, and Aunt Wee, Lindsay, Kevin, and I. And we gathered around her bed, taking turns whispering in her ear and hoping that she heard us. As her heart rate dropped and we realized that her time drew near, I opened a Gideon's Bible to a random passage and began to read. It was 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 12. "For now we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know even as also I am known." A few minutes later, she was dead. I didn't cry when Mamaw died, and I didn't cry for days thereafter. Aunt Wee and Lindsay grew frustrated with me, then worried. "You're just so stoic," they said. "You need to grieve like the rest of us, or you'll burst." I was grieving in my own way, but I sensed that our entire family was on the verge of collapse, and I wanted to give the impression of emotional strength. We all knew how Mom had reacted to Papaw's death, but Mamaw's death created new pressures. It was time to wind down the estate, figure out Mamaw's debts, dispose of her property, and disperse what remained. For the first time, Uncle Jimmy learned Mom's true financial impact on Mamaw. The drug rehab charges, the numerous loans never repaid. To this day, he refuses to speak to her. For those of us well acquainted with Mamaw's generosity, her financial position came as no surprise. Though Papaw had worked and saved for over four decades, the only thing of value that remained was the house he and Mamaw had purchased 50 years earlier. And Mamaw's debts were large enough to eat into a substantial portion of the home's equity. Lucky for us, this was 2005, the height of the real estate bubble. If she had died in 2008, Mamaw's estate likely would have been bankrupt. In her will, Mamaw divided what remained between her three kids with a twist. Mom's share was divided evenly between me and Lindsay. This undoubtedly contributed to Mom's inevitable emotional outburst. I was so caught up in the financial aspects of Mamaw's death and spending time with relatives I hadn't seen in months that I didn't realize Mom was slowly descending to the same place she traveled after Papaw's death. But it's hard to miss a freight train barreling down on you, so I noticed soon enough. Like Papaw, Mamaw wanted a visitation in Middletown so that all of her friends from Ohio could gather and pay their respects. Like Papaw, she wanted a second visitation and funeral back home in Jackson, at Deaton's. After her funeral, the convoy departed for Keck, a holler not far from where Mamaw was born that housed our family cemetery. In family lore, Keck held an even higher place of honor than Mamaw's birthplace. Her own mother, our beloved Mamaw Blanton, was born in Keck, and Mamaw Blanton's younger sister, Aunt Bonnie, nearly 90 herself, owned a beautiful log cabin on the same property. A short hike up the mountain from that log cabin is a relatively flat plot of land that serves as the final resting place for Papaw and Mamaw Blanton and a host of relatives, some born in the 19th century. That's where our convoy was headed, through the narrow mountain roads, to deliver Mamaw to the family who'd crossed over before her. I've made that drive with a funeral convoy probably half a dozen times, and every turn reveals a landscape that inspires some memory of fonder times. It's impossible to sit in the car for the 20-minute trip and not trade stories about the departed, all of which start out, "Do you remember that time?" But after Mamaw's funeral, we didn't recall a series of fond memories about Mamaw and Papaw, and Uncle Red and T-Berry, and that time Uncle David drove off the side of the mountain, rolled 100 yards down the hill, and walked away without a scratch. Lindsay and I instead listened to Mom tell us that we were too sad, that we loved Mamaw too much, and that Mom had the greater right to grief because, in her words, she was my mom, not yours. I have never felt angrier at anyone for anything. For years, I had made excuses for Mom. I had tried to help manage her drug problem, read those stupid books about addiction, and accompanied her to NA meetings. I had endured, never complaining, a parade of father figures, all of whom left me feeling empty and mistrustful of men. I had agreed to ride in that car with her on the day she threatened to kill me, and then I had stood before a judge and lied to him to keep her out of jail. I had moved in with her and Matt, and then her and Ken, because I wanted her to get better and thought that if I played along, there was a chance she would. For years, Lindsay called me the forgiving child, the one who found the best in Mom, the one who made excuses, the one who believed. I opened my mouth to spew pure vitriol in Mom's direction, but Lindsay spoke first. "No, Mom. She was our mom, too." That said it all, so I continued to sit in silence. The day after the funeral, I drove back to North Carolina to rejoin my Marine Corps unit. On the way back, on a narrow mountain back road in Virginia, I hit a wet patch of road coming around a turn, and the car began spinning out of control. I was moving fast, and my twisting car showed no signs of slowing as it hurtled towards the guardrail. I thought briefly that this was it, that I'd topple over that guardrail and join Mamaw just a bit sooner than I expected, when all of a sudden the car stopped. It is the closest I've ever come to a true supernatural event, and though I'm sure some law of friction can explain what happened, I imagined that Mamaw had stopped the car from toppling over the side of the mountain. I reoriented the car, returned to my lane, and then pulled off to the side. That was when I broke down and released the tears that I'd held back during the previous 2 weeks. I spoke to Lindsay and Aunt Wee before restarting my journey, and within a few hours I was back at the base. My final 2 years in the Marines flew by and were largely uneventful. The two incidents stand out, each of which speaks to the way the Marine Corps changed my perspective. The first was a moment in time in Iraq, where I was lucky to escape any real fighting, but which affected me deeply nonetheless. As a public affairs Marine, I would attach to different units to get a sense of their daily routine. Sometimes I'd escort civilian press, but generally I'd take photos or write short stories about individual Marines or their work. Early in my deployment, I attached to a civil affairs unit to do community outreach. Civil affairs missions were typically considered more dangerous, as a small number of Marines would venture into unprotected Iraqi territory to meet with locals. On our particular mission, senior Marines met with local school officials while the rest of us provided security or hung out with the school kids, playing soccer and passing out candy and school supplies. One very shy boy approached me and held out his hand. When I gave him a small eraser, his face briefly lit up with joy before he ran away to his family, holding his 2-cent prize aloft in triumph. I have never seen such excitement on a child's face. I don't believe in epiphanies. I don't believe in transformative moments, as transformation is harder than a moment. I've seen far too many people awash in genuine desire to change, only to lose their mettle when they realize just how difficult change actually is. But that moment with that boy was pretty close for me. For my entire life, I'd harbored resentment at the world. I was mad at my mother and father, mad that I rode the bus to school while other kids caught rides with friends, mad that my clothes didn't come from Abercrombie, mad that my grandfather died, mad that we lived in a small house. That resentment didn't vanish in an instant, but as I stood and surveyed the massive children of a war-torn nation, their school without running water, and the overjoyed boy, I began to appreciate how lucky I was. Born in the greatest country on earth, every modern convenience at my fingertips, supported by 2 loving hillbillies, and part of a family that, for all its quirks, loved me unconditionally. At that moment, I resolved to be the type of man who would smile when someone gave him an eraser. I haven't quite made it there, but without that day in Iraq, I wouldn't be trying. The other life-altering component of my Marine Corps experience was constant. From the first day with that scary drill instructor and a piece of cake, until the last when I grabbed my discharge papers and sped home, the Marine Corps taught me how to live like an adult. The Marine Corps assumes maximum ignorance from its enlisted folks. It assumes that no one taught you anything about physical fitness, personal hygiene, or personal finances. I took mandatory classes about balancing a checkbook, saving, and investing. When I came home from boot camp with my $1,500 earnings deposited in a mediocre regional bank, a senior enlisted Marine drove me to Navy Federal, a respected credit union, and had me open an account. When I caught strep throat and tried to tough it out, my commanding officer noticed and ordered me to the doctor. We used to complain constantly about the biggest perceived difference between our jobs and civilian jobs. In the civilian world, your boss wasn't able to control your life after you left work. In the Marines, my boss didn't just make sure I did a good job, he made sure I kept my room clean, kept my hair cut, and ironed my uniforms. He sent an older Marine to supervise as I shopped for my first car so that I'd end up with a practical car, like a Toyota or a Honda, not the BMW I wanted. When I nearly agreed to finance that purchase directly through the car dealership with a 21% interest rate loan, my chaperone blew a gasket and ordered me to call Navy Fed and get a second quote. It was less than half the interest. I had no idea that people did these things. Compare banks? I thought they were all the same. Shop around for a loan? I felt so lucky to even get a loan that I was ready to pull the trigger immediately. The Marine Corps demanded that I think strategically about these decisions, and then it taught me how to do so. Just as important, the Marines changed the expectations that I had for myself. In boot camp, the thought of climbing the 30-foot rope inspired terror. By the end of my first year, I could climb the rope using only one arm. Before I enlisted, I had never run a mile continuously. On my last physical fitness test, I ran 3 of them in 19 minutes. It was in the Marine Corps where I first ordered grown men to do a job and watch them listen, where I learned that leadership depended far more on earning the respect of your subordinates than on bossing them around, where I discovered how to earn that respect, and where I saw that men and women of different social classes and races could work as a team and bond like a family. It was the Marine Corps that first gave me an opportunity to truly fail, made me take that opportunity, and then, when I did fail, gave me another chance anyway. When you work in public affairs, the most senior Marines serve as liaisons with the press. The press is the holy grail of Marine Corps public affairs, the biggest audience and the highest stakes. Our media officer at Cherry Point was a captain who, for reasons I never understood, quickly fell out of favor with the base's senior brass. Though he was a captain, 8 pay grades higher than I was, because of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, there was no ready replacement when he got the axe. So my boss told me that for the next 9 months, until my service ended, I would be the media relations officer for one of the largest military bases on the East Coast. By then, I'd grown accustomed to the sometimes random nature of Marine Corps assignments. This was something else entirely. As a friend joked, I had a face for radio, and I wasn't prepared for live TV interviews about happenings on base. The Marine Corps threw me to the wolves. I struggled a bit at first, allowing some photographers to take photos of a classified aircraft, speaking out of turn at a meeting with senior officers, and I got my ass chewed. My boss, Sean Haney, explained what I needed to do to correct myself. We discussed how to build relationships with the press, how to stay on message, and how to manage my time. I got better, and when hundreds of thousands flocked to our base for a biannual air show, our media relations worked so well that I earned a commendation medal. The experience taught me a valuable lesson, that I could do it. I could work 20-hour days when I had to. I could speak clearly and confidently with TV cameras shoved in my face. I could stand in a room with majors, colonels, and generals and hold my own. I could do a captain's job even when I feared I couldn't. For all my grandma's efforts, for all of her, "You can do anything, don't be like those fuckers who think the deck is stacked against them" diatribes, the message had only partially set in before I enlisted. Surrounding me was another message, that I and the people like me weren't good enough, that the reason Middletown produced 0 Ivy League graduates was some genetic or character defect. I couldn't possibly see how destructive that mentality was until I escaped it. The Marine Corps replaced it with something else, something that loathes excuses. Giving it my all was a catchphrase, something heard in health or gym class. When I first ran 3 miles, mildly impressed with my mediocre 25-minute time, a terrifying senior drill instructor greeted me at the finish line. "If you're not puking, you're lazy. Stop being fucking lazy." He then ordered me to sprint between him and a tree repeatedly. Just as I felt I might pass out, he relented. I was heaving, barely able to catch my breath. "That's how you should feel at the end of every run," he yelled. In the Marines, giving it your all was a way of life. I'm not saying ability doesn't matter. It certainly helps. But there's something powerful about realizing that you've undersold yourself, that somehow your mind confused lack of effort for inability. This is why, whenever people ask me what I'd most like to change about the white working class, I say, the feeling that our choices don't matter. The Marine Corps excised that feeling like a surgeon does a tumor. A few days after my 23rd birthday, I hopped into the first major purchase I'd ever made, an old Honda Civic, grabbed my discharge papers, and drove one last time from Cherry Point, North Carolina to Middletown, Ohio. During my 4 years in the Marines, I had seen, in Haiti, a level of poverty I never knew existed. I witnessed the fiery aftermath of an airplane crash into a residential neighborhood. I had watched Mamaw die and then gone to war a few months later. I had befriended a former crack dealer who turned out to be the hardest working Marine I knew. When I joined the Marines, I did so in part because I wasn't ready for adulthood. I didn't know how to balance a checkbook, much less how to complete the financial aid forms for college. Now, I knew exactly what I wanted out of my life and how to get there. And in 3 weeks, I'd start classes at Ohio State. Chapter 11. I arrived for orientation at Ohio State in early September 2007, and I couldn't have been more excited. I remember every little detail about that day. Lunch at Chipotle, the first time Lindsay had ever eaten there. The walk from the orientation building to the South Campus house that would soon be my Columbus home. The beautiful weather. I met with a guidance counselor who talked me through my first college schedule, which put me in class only 4 days per week, never before 9:30 in the morning. After the Marine Corps and its 5:30 a.m. wake-ups, I couldn't believe my good fortune. Ohio State's main campus in Columbus is about 100 miles away from Middletown, meaning it was close enough for weekend visits to my family. For the first time in a few years, I could drop in on Middletown whenever I felt like it. And while Havelock, the North Carolina city closest to my Marine Corps base, was not too different from Middletown, Columbus felt like an urban paradise. It was, and remains, one of the fastest-growing cities in the country, powered in large part by the bustling university that was now my home. OSU grads were starting businesses, historic buildings were being converted into new restaurants and bars, and even the worst neighborhoods seemed to be undergoing significant revitalization. Not long after I moved to Columbus, one of my best friends began working as the promotions director for a local radio station, so I always knew what was happening around town and always had an in to the city's best events, from local festivals to VIP seating for the annual fireworks show. In many ways, college was very familiar. I made a lot of new friends, but virtually all of them were from Southwest Ohio. My six roommates included five graduates of Middletown High School and one graduate of Edgewood High School in nearby Trenton. They were a little younger. The Marine Corps had aged me past the age of the typical freshman, but I knew most of them from back home. My closest friends had already graduated or were about to, but many stayed in Columbus after graduation. Though I didn't know it, I was witnessing a phenomenon that social scientists call brain drain. People who are able to leave struggling cities often do, and when they find a new home with educational and work opportunities, they stay there. Years later, I looked at my wedding party of six groomsmen and realized that every single one of them had, like me, grown up in a small Ohio town before leaving for Ohio State. To a man, all of them had found careers outside of their hometowns, and none of them had any interest in ever going back. By the time I started at Ohio State, the Marine Corps had instilled in me an incredible sense of invincibility. I'd go to classes, do my homework, study at the library, and make it home in time to drink well past midnight with my buddies, then wake up early to go running. My schedule was intense, but everything that had made me fear the independent college life when I was 18 felt like a piece of cake now. I had puzzled through those financial aid forms with Mamaw a few years earlier, arguing about whether to list her or Mom as my parent guardian. We had worried that unless I somehow obtained and submitted the financial information of Bob Hamill, my legal father, I'd be guilty of fraud. The whole experience had made both of us painfully aware of how unfamiliar we were with the outside world. I had nearly failed out of high school, earning D's and F's in English 1. Now, I paid my own bills and earned A's in every class I took at my state's flagship university. I felt completely in control of my destiny in a way that I never had before. I knew that Ohio State was put up or shut up time. I had left the Marine Corps not just with a sense that I could do what I wanted, but also with the capacity to plan. I wanted to go to law school, and I knew that to go to the best law school, I'd need good grades and to ace the infamous law school admissions test, or LSAT. There was much I didn't know, of course. I couldn't really explain why I wanted to go to law school, besides the fact that in Middletown, the rich kids were born to either doctors or lawyers, and I didn't want to work with blood. I didn't know how much else was out there, but the little knowledge I had at least gave me direction, and that was all I needed. I loathed debt and the sense of limitation it imposed. Though the GI Bill paid for a significant chunk of my education, and Ohio State charged relatively little to an in-state resident, I still needed to cover about $20,000 of expenses on my own. I took a job at the Ohio State House, working for a remarkably kind senator from the Cincinnati area named Bob Shuler. He was a good man, and I liked his politics, so when constituents called and complained, I tried to explain his positions. I watched lobbyists come and go and overheard the senator and his staff debate whether a particular bill was good for his constituents, good for his state, or good for both. Observing the political process from the inside made me appreciate it in a way that watching cable news never had. Mamaw had thought all politicians were crooks, but I learned that no matter their politics, that was largely untrue at the Ohio State House. After a few months at the Ohio Senate, as my bills piled up and I found fewer and fewer ways to make up the difference between my spending and my income, one can donate plasma only twice per week, I learned, I decided to get another job. One nonprofit advertised a part-time job that paid $10 an hour, but when I showed up for the interview in khakis, an ugly lime green shirt, and Marine Corps combat boots, my only non-sneakers at the time, and saw the interviewer's reaction, I knew that I was out of luck. I barely noticed the rejection email a week later. A local nonprofit did work for abused and neglected children, and they also paid $10 an hour, so I went to Target, bought a nicer shirt and a pair of black shoes, and came away with a job offer to be a consultant. I cared about their mission, and they were great people. I began work immediately. With two jobs and a full-time class load, my schedule intensified, but I didn't mind. I didn't realize there was anything unusual about my commitments until a professor emailed me about meeting after class to discuss a writing assignment. When I sent him my schedule, he was aghast. He sternly told me that I should focus on my education and not let work distractions stand in my way. I smiled, shook his hand, and said thanks, but I did not heed his advice. I liked staying up late to work on assignments, waking up early after only 3 or 4 hours of sleep, and patting myself on the back for being able to do it. After so many years of fearing my own future, of worrying that I'd end up like many of my neighbors or family, addicted to drugs or alcohol, in prison, or with kids that I couldn't or wouldn't take care of, I felt an incredible momentum. I knew the statistics. I had read the brochures in the social worker's office when I was a kid. I had recognized the look of pity from the hygienist at the low-income dental clinic. I wasn't supposed to make it, but I was doing just fine on my own. Did I take it too far? Absolutely. I didn't sleep enough, I drank too much, and ate Taco Bell at nearly every meal. A week into what I thought was just a really awful cold, a doctor told me that I had mono. I ignored him and kept on living as though NyQuil and DayQuil were magical elixirs. After a week of this, my urine turned a disgusting brown shade and my temperature registered 103. I realized I might need to take care of myself, so I downed some Tylenol, drank a couple of beers, and went to sleep. When Mom found out what was happening, she drove to Columbus and took me to the emergency room. She wasn't perfect, she wasn't even a practicing nurse, but she took it as a point of pride to supervise every interaction we had with the healthcare system. She asked the right questions, got annoyed with doctors when they didn't answer directly, and made sure I had what I needed. I spent 2 full days in the hospital as doctors emptied 5 bags of saline to rehydrate me and discovered that I had contracted a staph infection in addition to the mono, which explained why I grew so sick. The doctors released me to Mom, who wheeled me out of the hospital and took me home to recover. My illness lasted another few weeks, which happily coincided with a break between Ohio State's spring and summer terms. When I was in Middletown, I split time between Aunt Wee's and Mom's. Both of them cared for me and treated me like a son. It was my first real introduction to the competing emotional demands of Middletown in a post-Mamaw world. I didn't want to hurt Mom's feelings, but the past had created rifts that would likely never go away. I never confronted these demands head-on. I never explained to Mom that no matter how nice and caring she was at any given time, and while I had mono, she couldn't have been a better mother. I just felt uncomfortable around her. To sleep in her house meant talking to husband number 5, a kind man but a stranger who would never be anything to me but the future ex, Mr. Mom. It meant looking at her furniture and remembering the time I hid behind it during one of her fights with Bob. It meant trying to understand how Mom could be such a contradiction, a woman who sat patiently with me at the hospital for days and an addict who would lie to her family to extract money from them a month later. I knew that my increasingly close relationship with Aunt Wee hurt Mom's feelings. She talked about it all the time. "I'm your mother, not her," she'd repeat. To this day, I often wonder whether, if I'd had the courage as an adult that I'd had as a child, Mom might have gotten better. Addicts are at their weakest during emotionally trying times, and I knew that I had the power to save her from at least some bouts of sadness, but I couldn't do it any longer. I didn't know what had changed, but I wasn't that person anymore. Perhaps it was nothing more than self-preservation. Regardless, I couldn't pretend to feel at home with her. After a few weeks of mono, I felt well enough to return to Columbus and my classes. I'd lost a lot of weight, 20 pounds over 4 weeks, but otherwise felt pretty good. With the hospital bills piling up, I got a third job as an SAT tutor at the Princeton Review, which paid an incredible $18 an hour. 3 jobs were too much, so I dropped the job I loved the most, my work at the Ohio Senate, because it paid the least. I needed money and the financial freedom it provided, not rewarding work. That, I told myself, would come later. Shortly before I left, the Ohio Senate debated a measure that would significantly curb payday lending practices. My senator opposed the bill, one of the few senators to do so, and though he never explained why, I like to think that maybe he and I had something in common. The senators and policy staff debating the bill had little appreciation for the role of payday lenders in the shadow economy that people like me occupied. To them, payday lenders were predatory sharks, charging high interest rates on loans and exorbitant fees for cash checks. The sooner they were snuffed out, the better. To me, payday lenders could solve important financial problems. My credit was awful, thanks to a host of terrible financial decisions, some of which weren't my fault, many of which were, so credit cards weren't a possibility. If I wanted to take a girl out to dinner, or needed a book for school and didn't have money in the bank, I didn't have many options. I probably could have asked my aunt or uncle, but I desperately wanted to do things on my own. One Friday morning, I dropped off my rent check, knowing that if I waited another day, the $50 late fee would kick in. I didn't have enough money to cover the check, but I'd get paid that day and would be able to deposit the money after work. However, after a long day at the Senate, I forgot to grab my paycheck before I left. By the time I realized the mistake, I was already home, and the State House staff had left for the weekend. On that day, a 3-day payday loan, with a few dollars of interest, enabled me to avoid a significant overdraft fee. The legislators debating the merits of payday lending didn't mention situations like that. The lesson? Powerful people sometimes do things to help people like me without really understanding people like me. My second year of college started pretty much as my first year had, with a beautiful day and a lot of excitement. With the new job, I was a bit busier, but I didn't mind the work. What I did mind was the gnawing feeling that, at 24, I was a little too old to be a second-year college student. But with 4 years in the Marine Corps behind me, more separated me from the other students than age. During an undergraduate seminar on foreign policy, I listened as a 19-year-old classmate with a hideous beard spouted off about the Iraq War. He explained that those fighting the war were typically less intelligent than those, like him, who immediately went to college. It showed, he argued, in the wanton way soldiers butchered and disrespected Iraqi civilians. It was an objectively terrible opinion. My friends from the Marine Corps spanned the political spectrum and had held nearly every conceivable opinion about the war. Many of my Marine Corps friends were staunch liberals who had no love for our commander-in-chief, then George W. Bush, and felt that we had sacrificed too much for too little gain. But none of them had ever uttered such unreflective tripe. As the student prattled on, I thought about the never-ending training on how to respect Iraqi culture. Never show anyone the bottom of your foot. Never address a woman in traditional Muslim garb without first speaking to a male relative. I thought about the security we provided for Iraqi poll workers and how we studiously explained the importance of their mission without ever pushing our own political views on them. I thought about listening to a young Iraqi who couldn't speak a word of English, flawlessly rap every single word of 50 Cent's "Into Club," and laughing along with him and his friends. I thought about my friends who were covered in third-degree burns, lucky to have survived an IED attack in the Al-Qaim region of Iraq. And here was this dipshit and a spotty beard telling our class that we murdered people for sport. I felt an immediate drive to finish college as quickly as possible. I met with a guidance counselor and plotted my exit. I'd need to take classes during the summer and more than double the full-time course load during some terms. It was, even by my heightened standards, an intense year. During a particularly terrible February, I sat down with my calendar and counted the number of days since I'd slept more than 4 hours in a day. The tally was 39. But I continued, and in August 2009, after 1 year and 11 months at Ohio State, I graduated with a double major, summa cum laude. I tried to skip my graduation ceremony, but my family wouldn't let me. So I sat in an uncomfortable chair for 3 hours before I walked across the podium and received my college diploma. When Gordon Gee, then president of the Ohio State University, paused for an unusually long photograph with the girl who stood in front of me in line, I extended my hand to his assistant, nonverbally asking for the diploma. She handed it to me, and I stepped behind Dr. Gee and down off the podium. I may have been the only graduating student that day to not shake his hand. On to the next one, I thought. I knew I'd go to law school after the next year. My August graduation precluded a 2009 start to law school, so I moved home to save money. Aunt Wee had taken Mamaw's place as the family matriarch. She put out the fires, hosted family gatherings, and kept us all from breaking apart. She had always provided me with a home base after Mamaw's death, but 10 months seemed like an imposition. I didn't like the idea of disrupting her family's routine. But she insisted, "J.D., this is your home now. It's the only place for you to stay." Those last months living in Middletown were among the happiest of my life. I was finally a college graduate, and I knew that I'd soon accomplish another dream, going to law school. I worked odd jobs to save money and grew closer to my aunt's two daughters. Every day I'd get home from work, dusty and sweaty from manual labor, and sit at the dinner table to hear my teenage cousins talk about their days at school and trials with friends. Sometimes I'd help with homework. On Fridays during Lent, I helped with the fish fries at the local Catholic church. That feeling I had in college, that I had survived decades of chaos and heartbreak and finally come out on the other side, deepened. The incredible optimism I felt about my own life contrasted starkly with the pessimism of so many of my neighbors. Years of decline in the blue-collar economy manifested themselves in the material prospects of Middletown's residents. The Great Recession and the not-great recovery that followed had hastened Middletown's downward trajectory. But there was something almost spiritual about the cynicism of the community at large, something that went much deeper than a short-term recession. As a culture, we had no heroes. Certainly not any politician. Barack Obama was then the most admired man in America, and likely still is. But even when the country was enraptured by his rise, most Middletonians viewed him suspiciously. George W. Bush had few fans in 2008. Many loved Bill Clinton, but many more saw him as the symbol of American moral decay, and Ronald Reagan was long dead. We loved the military, but had no George S. Patton figure in the modern army. I doubt my neighbors could even name a high-ranking military officer. The space program, long a source of pride, had gone the way of the dodo, and with it the celebrity astronauts. Nothing united us with the core fabric of American society. We felt trapped in two seemingly unwinnable wars, in which a disproportionate share of the fighters came from our neighborhood, and in an economy that failed to deliver the most basic promise of the American dream, a steady wage. To understand the significance of this cultural detachment, you must appreciate that much of my family's, my neighborhood's, and my community's identity derives from our love of country. I couldn't tell you a single thing about Breathitt County's mayor, its healthcare services, or its famous residents. But I do know this. Bloody Breathitt allegedly earned its name because the county filled its World War I draft quota entirely with volunteers, the only county in the entire United States to do so. Nearly a century later, and that's the factoid about Breathitt that I remember best. It's the truth that everyone around me ensured I knew. I once interviewed Mamaw for a class project about World War II. After 70 years filled with marriage, children, grandchildren, death, poverty, and triumph, the thing about which Mamaw was unquestionably the proudest and most excited was that she and her family did their part during World War II. We spoke for minutes about everything else. We spoke for hours about war rations, Rosie the Riveter, her dad's wartime love letters to her mother from the Pacific, and the day we dropped the bomb. Mamaw always had two gods, Jesus Christ and the United States of America. I was no different, and neither was anyone else I knew. I'm the kind of patriot whom people on the Acela Corridor laugh at. I choke up when I hear Lee Greenwood's cheesy anthem, "Proud to be an American." When I was 16, I vowed that every time I met a veteran, I would go out of my way to shake his or her hand, even if I had to awkwardly interject to do so. To this day, I refuse to watch Saving Private Ryan around anyone but my closest friends because I can't stop from crying during the final scene. Mamaw and Papaw taught me that we lived in the best and greatest country on earth. This fact gave meaning to my childhood. Whenever times were tough, when I felt overwhelmed by the drama and tumult of my youth, I knew the better days were ahead because I lived in a country that allowed me to make the good choices that others hadn't. When I think today about my life and how genuinely incredible it is, a gorgeous, kind, brilliant life partner, the financial security that I dreamed about as a child, great friends and exciting new experiences, I feel overwhelming appreciation for these United States. I know it's corny, but it's the way I feel. If Mamaw's second god was the United States of America, then many people in my community were losing something akin to a religion. The tie that bound them to their neighbors, that inspired them in the way my patriotism had always inspired me, had seemingly vanished. The symptoms are all around us. Significant percentages of white conservative voters, about one-third, believe that Barack Obama is a Muslim. In one poll, 32% of conservatives said that they believed Obama was foreign-born, and another 19% said they were unsure, which means that a majority of white conservatives aren't certain that Obama is even an American. I regularly hear from acquaintances or distant family members that Obama has ties to Islamic extremists, or is a traitor, or was born in some far-flung corner of the world. Many of my new friends blame racism for this perception of the president. But the president feels like an alien to many Middletonians for reasons that have nothing to do with skin color. Recall that not a single one of my high school classmates attended an Ivy League school. Barack Obama attended two of them and excelled at both. He is brilliant, wealthy, and speaks like a constitutional law professor, which of course he is. Nothing about him bears any resemblance to the people I admired growing up. His accent, clean, perfect, neutral, is foreign. His credentials